Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm feeling better this week here. A little better.
You are?
Well, you know, we talked about it was a sad week for me last week. Yeah. I lost a very long, dear friend of mine I've known for 45 years. Not easy to that's going to take a while to wrap my head around it, but I'm trying to do better here.
I've noticed you, I appreciate you, like, I just want to say again, you know, I appreciate you sharing that very personally last week. I thought it was appropriate for what we were doing, and I did see that you shared that, you know, a bunch more stuff about your friend over the course of the week, right, on social media.
Yes.
So,
and in fact, I shared that piece with his family, and they were very appreciative of it.
Oh, good. I'm glad. You know, it's a difficult time. I can only imagine.
Well, it's part of this difficult journey we're on here. You know, when I was 20, nobody died. When I was 40, few people died. Now, all of a sudden, I'm looking around and going, wait a minute, this can't be happening.
You know, can I just say something, because I want to kind of tie it in with the show at some point here, but because our guest, I think, it personifies what I mean, let me just put it this way. Okay, I'll introduce him right now, and then we'll bring him on the air. But I have the absolute honor and privilege today to have as my guest, and thank you so much, Frank, for being willing to sit on with me today. But Frank Shankwitz, who is the creator and one of the founders for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Wow.
Life's journey. We talk about life's journey, right? Mm-hmm. You asked me when I walked in. You go, oh, who do we have on the show? I mean, you don't pay attention to my pre-press, Paul.
Okay, I don't. I'm sorry. Too many shows on the station here.
But I actually want to thank our show friend Tanya Brown indirectly kind of introducing me to Frank, because there was an event and Frank and Tanya were there, and they are both were talking about their books, and that's how I met Frank. And to be honest, I didn't share this with Frank, but when I walked into that particular meeting that night, I had been kind of in one of those low moments, burnt out on a lot of my nonprofit involvement.
Yeah,
and
can really suck the life out of you, I think.
Kind of like, things, exactly. Yeah. And anybody who's served in that capacity knows what I'm talking about. And I was like, you know what? I'm just kind of done. You know, I'm kind of tired.
Right.
You know, and I was having a low moment. And then I listened to Frank share very passionately and very vulnerably his story and his life's journey. And it really rekindled my core reason why I basically want to be of service and give.
Good.
And so I really wanted to have Frank on the show, and I wanted to have a chance to share his story and
I think his story and Tanya's story both, and perhaps,
in a different way, and perhaps
even my little story this week, that life is filled with unexpected changes. You know, deaths can occur, problems can crop up, and we're not always ready to face them or how to deal with them.
And you know what? It's really kind of, I was trying to figure out how to, because we like to make these shows kind of current to something, right? Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out, like, what it was. And my recent experience in the last couple of months with the election cycle and you know, supporting some people locally and so forth, there's just so much negativity.
Oh.
There's so much finger-pointing. There's so much gotchas, you know, that we've almost lost the humanity of just being civil to one another and being of service to one another. And lo and behold, I just did a little blurb on social media, a live feed on Facebook, saying, hey, don't miss it on the show. We're about to go on the air, da-da-da. And I said, if anybody has any questions, call the station or whatever, right? So somebody posts on that little feed that was no more than a couple of minutes. This whole thing about litany about Trump and this and taxes and stuff has nothing to do with the show, has nothing to do with this
just
platform.
Just an opportunity to
and
rant.
It was an opportunity to rant. And it's like, you know what? I absolutely think we need more examples to be shared of people's journeys and how we have more things that unite us than divide us.
Yes.
So with that being said, Frank, I'm sure you've been listening, so I would like to introduce to everybody and welcome to the show, to The Rad Life, Mr. Frank Shankwitz. Frank, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you so much for the invite. I really appreciate it.
It's absolutely my pleasure, my friend. And if you will take a minute and just introduce yourself a little bit more, I cannot do you credit. And then I would like to just basically start with, you know, how How did you find yourself on this journey? I mean, I know that this, you went through a couple of career changes and things like that, and you know, there's a little phrase that I saw. You know, it's like a boy's wish that changed a man's life, who then changed the world.
Wow.
And I hope you can just maybe start us on that journey. Take us on that journey, Frank.
Well, it's kind of a different journey. I never thought it was extraordinary, but apparently a publishing company and Hollywood both think it's unique, because the book is just being released, Wishman, which is the story of my life up until I founded the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Then also, as I say, Hollywood contacted me a couple of years ago and said, we want to do Story Your Life. And I said, no, you don't. Yes, we do. I didn't think it was interesting, but they do. So we're in pre-production on that. And the movie title is also Wishman.
And is that book out, Frank, now?
Yes, the book is out. It's available on Amazon. I think it already sold out. I just saw the other day where it's out of print right now, out of stock. So,
well, so much for me buying it while we're online together. Okay. I'm gonna have to have you autograph one for me. But that's wonderful, because I knew it wasn't out. Just it hasn't been out for that long, right? I mean, last time we met, you were waiting for it to come out.
Yeah, it was just released last week.
Wow.
Yeah, so apparently...
Congratulations on that.
So tell us the story of Make-A-Wish. How did... What
well,
led
no, no,
you
no,
to
no,
Make-A-Wish?
No, 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 no. I want to hear the story of Frank.
Oh, the story of Frank, okay.
Yeah.
Before we get to why he...
You know what, Frank, I'm being very honest, right? Usually, Paul and I are just ranting and raving and ad-libbing and, you know, doing a little shtick on this thing. I don't want to waste 1 minute, because when I went to that Bespoke, and I'm going to give a shout out to Bespoke, Dave Welsh, and their custom tailoring shop, which jokingly we say, you know, he dresses me for radio, right?
Yeah.
But
he does it well.
And he does it very well. So, Dave, if you're listening, thanks for dressing me for radio. But you were in that room, and I remember I walked in, and like I said, I was like, huh, you know, whatever, give me a drink, you know, where's the food, is there anything? And then I just got kind of wrapped up in your story. And I just want to give you the mic, my friend. And go ahead and just take us on the life journey of Frank, because it's an amazing story, I think. And to your humbleness, I mean, when you say, I don't know, I didn't think, dude, I'm telling you, your story, that is an aspect of it, that humbleness that you bring with you is very much part of this, and why this is something that needs to be shared, and I'm glad that Hollywood is doing it. Your mic is yours. The floor is yours.
Okay. Well, just a brief synopsis. I was born in Chicago, and my mother left my father and I when I was like 2 or 3 years old. She would never tell me. We never had a close relationship, and even in later years, she would never tell me where she went. So I was raised by my grandparents. Obviously, my father was working up until the age of 5, and everything was, as they say, hunky-dory as far as you can remember back in those years.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the age of 5 in kindergarten, my mother reappeared, and I later learned that she had been in Arizona for those years, and kidnapped me off a playground.
Go.
And took me on an adventure to get back to Arizona, which was a strange route, mainly through Michigan, Indiana, etc.
Wow.
And those were very poor years. We lived in the back of the car, and this is before really the age of the homeless, as they say.
Right.
We lived in the back of the car. We lived in tents. We lived in flop houses. Meals were always a concern. It was just a very traumatic lifestyle for a young child. And we finally ended up in Arizona when I was 10 years old, a little town called Seligman, Arizona on Route 66. A lot of people don't know Seligman is Arizona, but if they ever saw the Disney animated feature Cars, Radiator Springs in the feature Cars is Seligman, Arizona. It was modeled after that. Little railroad cowboy town. And when we hit town, we were completely broke. No money, no anything, no gas. It was just literally ran out of gas at the edge of town. And a family took us in. And for the next 6 months, we slept on their kitchen floor in bedrolls.
Wow.
And I started noticing then that how people can give you things when they don't expect anything in return. This family was just basically poor themselves. Meals were biscuits and gravy, beans and tortillas. That was the main fare, just because that's about all they could afford. Mm-hmm. But they were feeding us. And also at 10 years old, I went to work full-time as a dishwasher and was able to start everything I made went to my mother so we could start hopefully getting some type of a home. And eventually got a little old travel trailer that some friends she had made helped fix up. It was a place to sleep, but it didn't have heat. It didn't have a bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
So she got a job as a motel maid. She got to use facilities at the hotel. Santa Fe Railroad provided me with all the hot water and everything I could ever use with their steam engine, a roundhouse, and so on.
Yeah.
So to me, it wasn't a bad life, and a lot of other kids in town were using that. But I met a gentleman named Juan Delgadillo who became my father figure. And my father, I found out later, had been trying to find me all those years.
I was going to say, he must have been frantically looking for you.
Yeah, he was. But Juan Delgadillo became, like I said, my mentor, my father figure, and just kind of coached me in everything. Taught me sports, taught me music, taught me how to develop character, integrity. But the biggest thing Juan told me was, someday, Frank, when you can, give back. And that wasn't a term. Now, we're in the 50s here, and that wasn't a term that's popular like it is now. And I said, Juan, what do you mean give back? We're looking for meals every day.
Right.
How can we possibly give back? And Juan said, you don't have to have money to give back, Frank.
Wow.
He said, you can give back by helping other people. He said, you see Mrs. Sanchez's yard over there? It's full of weeds. She's the widow lady. And yet she's always bringing you beans and tortillas. She's always making sure that you have something to eat. And you can give back by going over there and cleaning her yard.
Right.
You see Mr. Ortega, he's got an old caboose that was pulled off the Santa Fe Railroad that he's trying to make into the family home, and he's trying to sand and paint that. And they're helping you and your mother. You can give back by helping him out. You're strong enough. You can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remembered that because it took a, literally, as they say, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yep.
And Seligman was a population of about 500. And that was true in that little town. Everybody was trying to help everybody else out by somehow giving back. In seventh grade, when I started seventh grade, a little traumatic again. My mother notified me one day. She said, I'm moving to another town called Prescott, Arizona. I can't afford to take you with me. You're on your own.
Wow.
You're on your own?
In seventh grade?
In seventh grade.
12, 13, something.
Old,
wow.
Something like that, yeah.
Wow.
And that was, again, kind of devastating. And,
kind of. Sorry, I kidnapped you.
Understatement
in the middle of nowhere here, but I've run out of money here. So,
but I made arrangements with the widow lady, Mrs. Sanchez, that I could pay her room and board. I was making enough money as a dishwasher to cover that. But I went to Juan and I just said, you know, I'm really upset. I'm really mad. I'm everything else. I don't know what to do. And he's taught me that portion right there of how to turn the negatives to the positive.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you live in that crummy old trailer. You don't even have a bathroom. You have to go to the Santa Fe stations for showers mm-hmm. to use the bathroom. He said, look at Mrs. Sanchez. She's got that nice little house. You're going to have your own bedroom. You're going to have indoor plumbing. And right. plus that, she's the best cook in town. You're going to have three meals a day.
Wow. Look on the sunny side here, huh?
Exactly. Turn that negative to the positive. And I always remember that lesson that Juan had taught me.
Well, it sounds like a cliche, Frank, but, I mean, it's absolutely, there's a reason for it. And that's a perfect living example of it right there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Somebody once said, we can't change what happens to us, but we can change how we react to it.
Hmm.
Right. And in later years, I went to high school to Prescott and did reunite with my mother. We never did have a real close relationship.
Gee, I wonder why.
But she's my mother. I respect
sure,
her.
Right.
I had to respect her. But after high school, I joined the Air Force, served 4 years in the Air Force. It was Vietnam era, but I was not a combat veteran. Following the Air Force, I went to work at Motorola in Phoenix, Arizona, using the GI Bill.
How old were you at this point?
I got out of the Air Force. I was 21.
Okay.
And went to work for Motorola. There was a priority to hiring Vietnam-era veterans.
Yeah.
And quickly advanced there. They sent me to college, and I say along with the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Got into engineering. Great job, but I was very bored. I'm a small-town boy. Now I'm living in the big city, and it just wasn't
for you.
But excellent job at Motorola. Excellent benefits. But several of my friends had joined the Arizona Highway Patrol following their college years and kept saying, why don't you join that? You were air police in the Air Force. You've got the engineering degree. You'd be a perfect fit. I kept looking at it, and I said, I'm going to try. Just on a whim, I applied, got accepted. And in 1972, joined the Arizona Highway Patrol. And first duty station was down in Yuma, Arizona. And in some spare time, I got involved with Special Olympics. and really enjoyed working with the children on that, the special needs children.
Great program.
And as I was doing that, I started thinking about Juan and saying, Juan, maybe I'm finally giving back a little bit with my time. And within a year, in 1973, the Arizona Highway Patrol started a motorcycle program and asked me if I would apply for it, which I did. And I was chosen to be on a 10-man squad, motorcycle squad, that worked the whole state of Arizona, 2 weeks in one town, 2 weeks in another.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're into the mid-70s, and that's when the television show Chips became very popular.
Yeah, I was going to say, right.
Okay, if you remember it,
so Hollywood had something to do with you from way back.
Yeah, right. There was a connection there.
And in fact, we had trained with California Highway Patrol, our initial training.
You're saying something I remember when you were talking about this last time. It's like at that point, the uniforms actually were pretty much like Chips uniforms, and you trained with the California Highway Patrol. Yeah.
The big black boots and
And just coincidentally, our uniforms were almost identical. The motorcycles were almost identical, except ours obviously said Arizona. But that was about it. But what's so much fun about this show is we go into the towns. It was always a two-man team, these little towns and villages around Arizona. All of a sudden, the little kids, because the grade school kids love Chips.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we go right into town, and they start yelling, "Hey, Ponch, hey, John, hey, Chips." So it was a great PR tool.
Can I give you another little weird connection here? This is 6 degrees of separation. At that, a couple of years, around that same time, I was an entertainment publicist for up in Hollywood. And one of my longtime clients was the third lead, the sort of forgotten lead on that show, the little motorcycle mechanic, Lou Wagner, who fixed, comic relief.
Sure.
He fixed all the motorcycles and everything here. And still friends with him to this day here. But so I'm very familiar with the popularity of Chips and obviously was on the set and got to meet lots of those guys.
How funny.
Well, a little sidebar before I go further. Sure. I had the opportunity 2 years ago to meet Larry Wilcox.
Sure, right.
I was speaking at an event, and they said, "Tell us about Chips." And I told them, they said, "Have you ever met Larry Wilcox?" And I said, "No." They said, "Well, turn around." And there he was coming up on stage. So we remain friends today. It's a fun...
There you go, Larry. Well, tell him that you met somebody who knows Lou Wagner. I'll remember Lou Wagner. And anyway, so small world. All right, so we're all in the Chips era here, and you're a Chip.
Yeah, but during our kind of slow time in these towns, I asked permission if we could go into the grade schools and talk about bicycle safety to the grade school kids, which they could care less about. They just wanted to get on the motorcycles, just like the kids would do. And again, it was a great PR tool.
Mm-hmm.
In 1978, I was involved with a high-speed chase in a little town called Parker, Arizona, on the Colorado River, Arizona, California border. And as I was chasing this drunk driver at 80 miles an hour, another drunk driver pulled right in front of me, hit him broadside. They say the crash was spectacular. I was pronounced dead at the scene.
Wow.
And my partner tried to bring me back. He couldn't do it. They called in. I listened to the radio transmissions later. 963A officer killed in the line of duty. An off-duty emergency room nurse from California. God, I love California.
Yeah,
we love you too.
Yeah. Stopped and asked permission, and she identified herself so she could please try to bring me back. For the next 4 minutes, she worked on me and, in fact, did bring me back to life.
Wow.
And I'll always remember that lady. It took 6 months to recover from that accident with skull fractures, traumatic brain injuries, et cetera, et cetera. But when I was cured, I made sure that she got a lot of flowers and candy and so on.
Nice.
I have to ask a question because I occasionally meet people who've had near-death experiences. And at our age, this is partly about aging baby boomers and this aging journey, we're all afraid of what that is. Any remembrances, any feelings? Did you see the light or anything? Or was it just you woke up and you were in a hospital room?
No, as a matter of fact, I learned later what they called the tunnel. And as your life goes away, the tunnel is closing, the little light at the end, it goes out and you're dead. Everything, all the functions have stopped. As she's bringing me back to life, that little light opens up the tunnel and you start seeing things, the senses come back. And I always like to say in my presentations, police officers have to live with some humor.
Yeah.
And again, I learned this, how that when you come back, that tunnel starts opening, you do regain some senses. And the first sense that I had was a sense of smell. Hmm. And I smelled this real nice, sweet thought thing, like a perfume. The next sense was a sense of hearing. And I'm hearing sirens and screaming. She's brought him back. What are you talking about? The sense of touch. Something is tickling my face. Then the next sense of touch again. Something's on my lips. Very pleasant. The sense of sight comes back. I open my eyes, and here's this beautiful blonde with a lip lock on me. And I'm thinking, if this is heaven, this is okay. But it, like I say, it took 6 months to recover from that accident. And when I did go back to work, there was just kind of this sense of loss. Why did God spare me? And every police officer believes in some type of higher being. You go to work every day, you say a little prayer, please allow me to come home.
Yeah,
you get home at night, thank you for allowing me to come home.
It's like they say, there aren't many atheists in a foxhole.
Exactly, exactly. Right. And why? Why did I survive? Why did God spare me on this?
Right.
In 1980, I'm on duty. I'm up in the mountains of northern Arizona. I get a call from the dispatcher, and this is before cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a call from the dispatcher, say, find the nearest payphone. We have an emergency message for you. It doesn't involve your family, but this is code 3, get to a phone, meaning get there as quick as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what was going on. The closest payphone was about 40 miles away. I call in. The dispatcher says, we have been introduced to a little boy, 7 years old. His name is Chris. Chris has leukemia, only a couple weeks to live. And his heroes are Ponch and John from the television show Chips.
Hmm.
That's all he talks about to his mother. When I grow up, I'm going to be a highway patrol motorcycle officer like Ponch and John.
Hmm.
And they said, you're going to make an arrangement to pick up Chris at his hospital with our state police helicopter, fly him to our headquarters building, and the director would like you to be standing by. And they chose me just because I had worked with these children all over the state.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
On your motorcycle, so when a helicopter lands, this little boy can meet one of somebody that looks like Chips.
Yeah.
And I was very tan at the time and had red hair, so I could have been Larry Wilcox or Eric Estrada, either one. And I had no idea what to expect. And I had quite a ways to go. They timed it because I had about another 100 miles to get down to Phoenix. And they timed it when I got there, I radioed, and the helicopter would land just as I was coming into this landing area.
Wow. And how did they arrange this? Did she must have reached out to the Arizona Department of Highway Safety or whatever it's called and said...
Yeah, Department of Public Safety, and a customs agent had befriended this little boy and contacted our department and said, just made this request, is there anything you could do for this little boy with Chips? And that's all it took was a phone call, and our department got into action right away. And this is obviously with permission of his mother, Chris's mother,
sure.
And his doctor.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Somebody made a call.
Somebody made a phone call. And
it touched
together.
Somebody at a higher... You somehow think you'll never get through when you call big government, big organizations, big corporations. I'm not going to get through. They're not going to see me as a real person. I'm never going to reach anybody. And yet occasionally it works and you get through to the right person and it touches them enough to say, we're going to do something about this.
Yeah, and we're a public service agency anyhow. This is what we do.
Right.
Not just put people in jail.
Right.
But and this all came together within one day. So, and that's why they get there as quick as possible. We're putting this together in one day because this little boy only had a couple weeks to live per his doctors.
Huh.
But the helicopter lands. I don't know what to expect. I've never met this little boy. I figure our paramedics are going to help him out of the helicopter. He just came off IVs.
Wow.
Instead, the helicopter door opened a little. Red sneakers jumps out of there, runs over, just bubbling all over. Hi, I'm Chris. Can I get on your motorcycle? And I'm just laughing. This boy had watched Chip so much, he knew every button and switch on the motorcycle.
Yeah.
This is for the red lights. Can I turn it on? This is the siren. Can I turn it on? This is for your flashers. What's in your saddlebags? It's the same as Ponch has. And
wow.
And any little boy that loves motorcycles, obviously he's on my high list right away anyhow.
Yeah.
But Chris went on that day to become the first and only honorary highway patrol officer in the history of the Arizona Highway Patrol.
Wow. Wow.
They were given, and that's 36 years ago now. He was assigned his own badge, which is still assigned to him today. Made a sworn in, like I say, as an honorary highway patrol officer. Got the tour of the armory. Was given a smoky hat like the car officers wear. And got to go home that night because the doctor who was with him said, I don't understand. His vitals are so good that let's let him go to his car.
He just came off IVs, too.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And I'm watching him. He's a typical 7-year-old. I'm looking at his mother. She's got tears in her eyes because, again, she's seeing a typical 7-year-old instead of a little boy laying in a hospital bed.
Right. God knows when was the last time she saw that in her son.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he did go home that night, but we were really feeling good about what we had done. And one of the officers said, well, an officer needs a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the uniforms were custom made. We ran over to the uniform shop in Phoenix just as it was closing. We said, we've got this 7-year-old. He's about this high, this wide. Can you make a uniform for him?
Mm-hmm.
And two ladies spent all night making the uniform for Chris.
Wow.
And I'm just watching this in amazement. Here's somebody they don't even know, and yet they are giving back in any way they can.
So let me stop you for a second.
Yeah,
so
sure.
What was so – I mean, it's a touching story, but there must be lots of touching requests. Or sad things that you encounter as a highway patrolman, people in desperate need, people who had dying or in jail or whatever. What was it about this story that just opened all the doors? Was it just the right time because Chips is popular and somebody said, hey, we can, this isn't a, what a great idea.
Have you
we'll
thought
capitalize
that-
on the connection with Chips and it'll be a great PR thing, or was it, I mean, it seems like it opened a lot of doors more than just
Reflecting back on it, Frank, was there something that made this just kind of line up?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was just, the cosmic stars that it all lined up. And it wasn't a PR thing whatsoever. Mm. This was just a request to help this little boy. And like I said, the department was very involved with Special Olympics anyhow. Our association, as we call it, Arizona Highway Patrol Association, sponsored the Special Olympics every year.
Mm-hmm.
We like working with the children. So it just everything was coming together.
Something about this story, though, just made everything open. I mean, it almost seemed, my wife would say this is divine will or something.
Oh,
you know,
might very well be.
You know, that everything just somehow, because there must be lots of touching stories in the Special Olympics, too, and yet none of the children somehow made all this happen in the same way that this did.
So anyway, here you are looking to find somebody to sew a uniform.
Yeah, and they just go, sure, we'll do it
which,
all night,
which
yeah.
overnight. Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah,
and I got permission the next day to leave lead a group of motorcycles and highway patrol cars to Chris's home in the suburb of Phoenix. And we went out there the next morning, red lights and sirens. You can imagine the neighbors.
Oh, yeah. Right.
What's happening? Who's getting arrested?
And Chris comes running out just ecstatic to see everybody, our new little trooper. Hand him his uniform. The little boy's got tear in his eyes. He runs in there. We're feeling good again. Comes out just beaming, wearing his uniform. He's got on a smoky hat, just beaming. But he runs over to me and asks to get on a motorcycle, of course, and he touches the wings that are on my uniform for significance of a motorcycle officer. And he said, I'm so happy, my wish is becoming true. And that's the first time I heard that word, wish. And he said, but I want to be a motorcycle officer. How do I do that? And I just started teasing him, telling him the training we took and that. And I said, it's a shame you don't have a motorcycle, Chris, because we'd set up traffic cones and we'd test you right here. Chris is a step ahead of me. He runs in the house, comes out riding on a little battery-operated motorcycle his mother had got for him in place of a wheelchair. He's got on that motorcycle helmet we have given him. He's wearing a pair of aviator sunglasses like we wear.
Yeah, right.
But the biggest thing I just started laughing was he had put on a pair of what we call on a ranch mucking boots, the high black rubber boots.
Yeah, right.
With his pants legs tucked in, it looks like our motorcycle boots. He's all serious.
You're not stomping him, Frank. You're not stomping him, right?
We set up the traffic cones. Chris goes through it. He comes back very serious. Did I pass? Yes, you did. Am I a motorcycle officer now? Yes, you are, Chris. He's laughing and giggling. Then he says, when do I get my wings?
Mm-hmm.
That was very important to him. Those were custom-made also. I said, Chris will order those for you. Chris gets to stay home again that night. the doctor says, I don't understand. Everything is fine. His vitals, let him stay home. I go order the motorcycle wings from a jeweler that was in another suburb. He says they'll be ready in a couple days. A couple days later, I pick up the wings. I get a call from the dispatcher. Chris is in a hospital in a coma. He's probably not going to survive the day.
Yeah.
I get permission to go to the hospital. As I walk in his room, his uniform is hanging right by his bed. Just as I pin the wings on his uniform, Chris comes out of the coma.
Oh, my God. Come on. This is unbelievable.
Right? Yeah. Did you just get chills?
It's like a movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
I see why Hollywood reacted to this. Yeah, right.
Yeah, he looks at me. He just starts smiling. Am I a motorcycle officer now? Yes, you are, Chris. His wish had become true. I hand him his uniform. He's rubbing the wings. He's showing them to his mother. He giggles a little bit. He passed away just a few hours later.
Oh, my God.
And he had his wings.
I'd like to think maybe those wings helped carry him to heaven.
Yeah. Right. He got another set of wings.
Our department contacted, the director contacted me and said we had lost a fellow officer. We learned that Chris is going to be buried in a little town called Kewaunee, Illinois, and I would like you to go back with another motorcycle officer and give Chris a full police...
Not Arizona, Illinois.
Illinois.
See, again, I mean, this is just as incredible. I mean, this story just touched people in a way that they were willing to make that kind of special arrangements and cost.
Keep going, Frank.
Yeah, and the director said, unfortunately, I can't make this a state-authorized mission. You're going to have to go on vacation time if you'll do it, and we're going to have to cover your own expenses. He said, I've already started passing the hat. We're going to get enough money for your airfare, for your expenses.
For a burial of a fellow officer.
Right. And we did. And a couple days later, we're on an airplane to Illinois. During the journey, the media had started picking this up. NBC especially, nationwide, started televising this whole story. And when we landed in Chicago, we were met by the press, which just surprised me, asking the story about Chris. So many people were interested. As we're driving to the little town of Kewaunee, Illinois State Police stopped us.
Oh, Frank, let me just again.
Sure.
For the purpose of time frame, what year was this?
This is 1980.
No internet.
1980.
No, right. Barely cell phones.
Yeah, hard for things to go viral.
Yeah. So for this story to catch wind of something, I mean, it's not like you're seeing it on a news feed on Facebook.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Frank. Sorry.
Yeah, we're stopped by Illinois State Police because we're in our full dress motorcycle uniforms, and the trooper stopped us, not because we were speeding, but he thinks maybe this is a scene out of Smokey and the Bandit. What's going on here? Just told him the story. He said, okay. He said, I'm going to escort you to the end of my jurisdiction, and then I'm going to have another trooper pick you up so you have escort all the way, and you won't be bothered by anybody. When we got to the little town of Kewaunee, Illinois, we were met by several Illinois State Police, City Police, County Police. This trooper had called into his commander, told him what we were doing, and all these agencies wanted to join in to help give this little Arizona trooper a full police funeral.
Wow. Wow.
Chris was buried in uniform. His grave marker reads, Chris Gracious, Arizona Trooper.
Wow.
But coming home, flying home from Illinois, I just started thinking about all the people that had helped this little boy, and they hadn't even met him. They helped us. They were helping everybody.
Exactly.
They wanted somehow to give back. And I just started thinking, Chris had a wish, and we made it happen. Why can't we do that for other children?
Amazing.
And at 36,000 feet, that's when the idea of the Make-A-Wish Foundation was born.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't Make-A-Wish have wings on it? Don't you have wings?
No.
Star.
A star, yeah, or something.
Right? A star, yeah. Kind of a whoosh like a Nike.
So what happened when your plane landed? I mean, it's amazing that you know, you had a chance at a moment to actually sit back, and you were not involved in the doing, and which was very instinctive, and all of a sudden this thing comes to you that, you know, we made it happen for Chris. Why can't we do it for other people?
And the power of making a little child's last wish come true, and how people responded to that, from the people who sewed the uniforms and made the wings to the department that gave you time off and raised, and the anonymous people that kicked in to raise money, and the escorts, and everybody, just seemed like everybody who heard the story instantly said, I want in on this.
Frank, how long from when you initially were called to go out and meet Chris. Two, when he passed and basically had the firmware and you were sitting on this plane. How long of a time frame was that?
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Quick, yeah.
2 weeks.
Right. Right. 2 week time.
2 weeks, guys. Okay.
All right, so now you got to make this. I'll tell you what, can we take a quick break? We'll leave it right
there. Let's take a break. That's a good place to stop.
We'll take a break, and we'll come back, and then you can tell us how Make-A-Wish became a reality, how you made it
a
reality.
We'll be right back, guys. Thanks,
all right,
Frank.
All right.
Do you want a free analysis of your inbound marketing? Do you want it in 30 seconds or less? Then check out Marketing Grader, the free marketing tool from HubSpot. It's simple. Just go to marketinggrader.com, enter the URL that you want to analyze, and Marketing Grader will instantly give you a detailed report grading your lead generation, mobile marketing, social media, competitive benchmarking, and more. It's simple, it's powerful, and it's free. MarketingGrader.com.
Like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, Your Home for a Lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call Your Home for a Lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
And we're back with our very special guest, Mr. Frank Shankwitz, creator and one of the founders of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. We've just spent the last half an hour talking about how life journeys
like,
and being open to just being open to life sometimes. I mean, over a course of 2 weeks, a boy's wish changes and shapes a man's destiny or sense of purpose and hones it, okay, by doing something that was just reacting. It wasn't. There was no scripting. There was no PR. It was just people giving and being there for other people.
Something about this story just made all the stars line up. It definitely opened and touched everybody's heart. And you were wise enough and inspired enough sitting in the plane to see, hey, if we could do this once, why couldn't we do this again?
So what happens when the plane lands, Frank?
Well. Right away, the Arizona Press, TV, and newspapers got a hold of me. They're following this whole story. And I just mentioned the idea that I want to start this foundation called the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Actually, it was going to be called the Gracious Make-A-Wish Foundation in honor of the little boy. And I had to wait until his mother came home from Illinois. And she was the first one I approached. I had this idea of, yes, let's do this. Let's start this foundation. But the hardest part was finding other people. Because in Arizona, I had to have a total of five founders, a total of five co-founders to start this. And I went to everybody that was involved with this, and everybody told me it's a bad idea, it's never going to work, we don't have the time, it's just going to have no interest. So it was very hard to find those five people, which took a couple months. And finally did find the five people that are four other people that would help me put this together. And once we got going on that, boom, it went. And 6 months later, in November of 1980, we received our 501c3, became official, and we were ready to start.
But I got to stop you. You make it sound like this is, again, like one of those Hollywood movies, the old Mickey Rooney, Andy Hardy movies where they're just going to make, let's make a movie, kids. Let's make a stage show. And then 3 weeks, by the end of the movie, everybody pulled it together and this wonderful production takes place. Go Google it if you're under a certain age. You don't know who Mickey Rooney is, right, and all those things. But right, there was a series of movies he made in the 20s and 30s where they just every movie was like that. Let's make a show. What did you know about starting a foundation? You're a motorcycle officer. What do you know about 501c3s and legal setups and fundraising and whatnot?
And not a thing, not a thing. And this is the days before internet. This is even the days before computers. We're still using typewriters.
Yeah, right. So you can't just go Google it and say, how do I set up a foundation, right?
So in college, you learn all about the research and the libraries, and that's where I spent the majority of my off-duty time was in libraries. How do you start a 501c3?
I had index cards and
I had a very close friend that was an attorney, and that's not an oxymoron. Attorneys can't be friends.
So that helped, yeah, because you need some legal guidance, right?
Right. And told him it, and he said, let's do this. So I'll help you get this together so you get all the paperwork for the 501c3. Another friend that was an accountant, and he said, my God, I want to get involved in this. Let's do this. And, yeah, just a lot of research. Just a lot of time, a lot of off-duty time.
Frank, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. I want to give people a chance. If you've been listening in and, or you're joining us right now, I just want to give a repeat of the phone number. If anybody has any questions for Frank or would like to be on the air, we're at some point here close to the end of the show. Or you can call us at any time, really. 949-330-7761. 949-330-7761, and if you're listening, you already know to go to octalkradio.net and click the Listen Live.
Or you can tweet us.
Or you can tweet us also at hashtag octalkradio.
Right.
So you're doing all this research. You know, to Paul's point, this isn't something that's in your wheelhouse per se. So there's got to be some doubt. I mean, all these people are telling you it's not, you know, it's never going to work, whatever. How do you balance that out? I mean, what keeps you going? What's the commitment?
Why don't you give in and say, you know,
why'd you give in?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, as Juan Delgadillo told me when I was 10 years old, 11 years old, turn all those negatives to a positive. And I remembered that.
Well done.
That exactly. Everybody said, you can't do this. Well, why can't I? And I'm going to find out how to say the negative to the positive. And I've done that. In fact, even police training, they later in my detective years, they're taught that.
Something tells me, Frank, that you're one of those people that if I wanted to get you to do something, I'd tell you couldn't do it.
but we're going to do it the right way. We're going to make sure it's all legal and everything else.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
All right, so we got to jump ahead because we're running out of time. So you do the impossible. You set up a foundation. Now what? The money doesn't just come in day one.
Yeah, because actually that's a cool story, too. The first person that you now as an official or an established nonprofit now that you get to basically now honor a wish.
Yeah, you don't have an office. You don't have a fundraising staff. You don't have anything.
Yeah,
you just exist.
The office was my kitchen. I'm the first president and CEO. I'm trying to work my job as a police officer and trying to run the foundation.
Right.
But our first donation was $15. A friend of mine said, let's open a bank account.
Yeah, right. So you're off and running. $15.
We're getting such good press in Arizona about what we were doing. I mean, it was like every other week the newspapers, the media was contacting me. How's this going? How's it working? And
so they didn't let the story die. Because normally when the news cycle is over, as they say, tomorrow's newspaper forgets about yesterday's headline here.
Yeah, and this is something brand new. Nobody had ever heard of this. There's nothing like this in the United States or the world. In March of 1980, we granted our first official wish. Again, a 7-year-old boy, leukemia. And he couldn't make up his mind what he wanted to do. He wanted to be a fireman. He wanted to ride in a hot air balloon. He wanted to go to Disneyland. and he just couldn't make up his mind. And the charter that we wrote in those days, and still the same today, we're very proud of that. A child gets one wish. But being a president and CEO, I told our board, we're going to grant all three. We're going to break the charter.
I'm breaking the charter already.
Yeah.
Because we're going to get such good press on this, it's just going to make the foundation grow.
Right.
It was very easy for a fireman, Phoenix Fire. We had the contacts. My girlfriend at the time, her brother was a fireman. That was easy to do. Hot air balloon, I knew the people in my hometown of Prescott. That was easy to do. Disney was a different story. They had never heard of us. I kept calling them, trying to tell who we are. I sent some press over there. All we're asking for is some free admission to cut costs, maybe some meals over there and that. They just wouldn't listen to me. Now, I based the foundation on integrity, accountability, transparency, I finally called Disney, not as the president of Make-A-Wish Foundation, but as motorcycle officer Frank Shank with the Arizona Highway Patrol.
And that call they take.
And they said, what is the problem? I said, I need to talk to your director of public relations because I have a warrant for one of your people. Now, I just said I base this foundation on integrity.
Yes, exactly.
And I'm going to use a little malarkey here, right? A little mischief.
I got the person I needed to talk to immediately. The first thing I told them was, here's my name, here's my badge number, here's my supervisor's name. I just lied to you. You can call and get me fired immediately, but will you please listen to my story? He did listen to my story. Disney is now one of the biggest sponsors 36 years later.
Good for them.
Wish Foundation.
Good for them.
Sometimes you got to just do a little bit of lying.
The door closes, you go through the window, right?
Yeah. Right.
That's fast, phenomenal. And how?
But,
and
but
you were
because
and,
of Bopsy. Then all of a sudden we got nationwide press again.
Right.
This little boy.
Now, at what point does money start coming in, and it turns into more than just your own little personal kitchen
table
passion project here?
Right after Bopsy, we're only 6 months old, and right after that, the boy went to Disneyland. And, again, getting the nationwide press, and we started really getting the funds. Now, I never took a salary. I had a job. All the money I wanted to go to the foundation to help make it grow.
Mm-hmm.
But after a couple of years, I couldn't do both. I realized that I'm not an expert in nonprofit. I've got my job. My director, just the neatest man in the world, said, I know what you're doing. I approve what you're doing. But I want you to work 8 hours a day. It may take you 15 or 16 hours,
mm-hmm.
but I want you to give me 8 hours of good work a day.
Mm-hmm.
So I always maintain my high arrest record, DUI arrest record, and so mm-hmm. on, to honor that man. But it dawned on us, our board, that we needed the professionals in the nonprofit world.
Yeah, right. It's a business.
And we needed to start hiring the people that do this. Like they say, surround yourself with the smart people.
Yeah. Right. It's a business to sustain this.
Yeah.
There are millions of worthy charities out there. Yeah.
Yeah. And in 1982, we hired our first person, and that's about the time I went into undercover narcotics and had to leave for a while. I couldn't have my face or name out there. So.
Yeah. And you were there for how long, Frank? I mean, you're still involved, I know, but you're a little bit more of a
emeritus
now, right? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And for years and years, an ambassador for the program, going all over the country on speaking engagements, keynote speeches, meeting sponsors, explaining the mission. I had to give all of that up 2 years ago, though, because of possible conflict of interest, because of a book, because of a movie. You cannot use the Make-A-Wish name for any personal gain for yourself.
Right.
Got it.
And so I resigned my board positions in that because I don't want anybody coming up and saying, look, you're trying to do something that's against the policy of the foundation.
Right. And indirectly, the book and the movie is only going to basically feed positively to the foundation anyway, I would
yes,
think.
Yes.
And what made you write the book and do that? Why tell the story in a bigger tale? Why document this?
I had met a gentleman in 2014 named Greg Reed,
mm-hmm.
who invited me to come to a speaking event in San Diego. And he said, why don't you do this for a living on the speaking? I said, well, I don't. I speak only at the foundation. He said, no, why don't you do this for a living? Because
mm-hmm.
he knew I was getting, ready to retire. And I said, I never thought about it. And spoke at a couple events in the San Diego area and got great response. And that's when I say the publisher contacted me. Mm-hmm. Hollywood contacted me, said, mm-hmm. my God, we want to get involved in this.
And so the book came out, and it's already been optioned by some major studio, is that what I understand, or producer or something?
It is an independent studio. In fact, it was in Beverly Hills just this last Wednesday, and we're going to start pre-production. We're working on a screenplay now for a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and I've got script approval on that, and Hollywood sometimes...
Good, because they will take the script and turn it into something else here. Yeah, there'll be there'll be car crashes and other things thrown in just for effect.
And I've learned, being a novice in this, I've learned when based on a true story
yeah.
is not the true story. But a true story would be a documentary. It would be boring.
Right. Right.
So,
how does the story end? What is the give a cut to the chase here?
You're asking him to give you the ending of the movie?
I'm asking. I want to see the ending of the movie, ending of the book.
No, you got to pay your $10.
Because it seems like it's an ongoing thing, so it doesn't seem like there's a...
And it's a period piece from 1950 to 1980, when I started the foundation, and that's the end of the movie is when, in fact, the founding the foundation.
Right, that makes sense.
You know what? I was just watching the Steve Jobs movie yesterday on HBO, and they ended it with the launch of the iMac. Mm-hmm. So
we know the rest of the story.
But you know, Frank, we start off by saying, and I hope you could take just a couple of minutes and maybe share some your own maybe mantra or your
down
own
to our last
life lessons kind of thing. But you know, we live in a time right now, especially heightened by the election season, of just, you know, a lot of finger pointing, a lot of taking a lot of energy and time basically doing sort of like gotcha moments or highlighting the negatives and things that don't unify people and things of that nature. And I really wanted the timeliness of your story, because here's a situation where we find more that is in common. And out of that comes a common good. And I hope if you could take a few minutes and just maybe share a little bit of that
life lesson.
Yeah, what has it meant to you? How has it shaped your life?
Well, it changed my life drastically, this whole event. One of the things I did mention, and back in my motorcycle years, I was also assigned to called a fatal accident team. There were 10 of us that they chose to, because of our engineering background, that would investigate nothing of the most horrific accidents. And the reason for that was the fatal accidents. And that was because the average patrolman didn't have this type of training. It would pull him off the road for 2 to 3 weeks trying to figure all this out and put it together. And our department decided that to get these 10 guys highly trained, because these were homicides.
Mm-hmm.
When you're killing people on the road, this isn't just a traffic accident. Somebody has killed somebody,
yeah,
and they're going to jail for it. And
so you have to lay out the detail, how fast they were going and at what point they started
the
to stop
thing,
and everything.
Well, you're seeing a lot of carnage. You're seeing a lot of really the horrible side of humanity.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just not only regular duties, but then on this, there was not very little off time. And ended up within went to a psychiatric ward. I told my sergeant, I'm seeing so many dead bodies, I can't sleep at night. It's nothing but ghosts. And I need some help of some type. And in those days, it was, you know, bite the bullet.
Yeah, right.
There was no counseling type thing. So he secretly checked me in on some vacation time into psychiatric ward and spent 10 days just counseling, talking, getting rid of all the ghosts, all the things. But the biggest thing they said to me at that point, too, is you have to find your purpose in life.
Mm.
And I found that a couple years later when I met Chris. And because of Chris, it just changed my whole life.
And you weren't really looking. It sounds like it was more like you were open to it, and it kind of found you?
Exactly. Like I said, that phone call from a dispatcher. Go find a payphone.
And so many others, when you came back and said, well, let's do this again. Let's repeat this wonderful experience, went, no, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I don't have the time, talent, energy to do this.
So if you had to share, and I know we're getting pretty close here, Frank. I mean, I would love to have more time with you, and maybe we'll have you again maybe once the movie gets a little closer. Or, you know, I'm going to get that book, man, so I'm sending it to you. I want an autograph. Better still, when you're in town in Southern California, I'd love to buy you a drink or a cup of coffee and sit down and have you do that. But what would you share with the listeners? I mean, if you had to impart some kind of life lesson or wisdom or something, people like a take
what's
away,
the takeaway?
What's the takeaway?
Everybody's going to go
you?
Home and shake their head and say, "Well, that was him. This can't ever happen to me."
The takeaway is everyone can be a hero. That is one of my models. Everyone can be a hero, and you can be a hero in your own community by your friends and this and that, just by giving back some of your time. It doesn't take money. Just a little bit of time to help somebody else out. That's what it's all about, helping people out.
That piece of friendly advice from a gentleman back in the days in a little town in Arizona just stuck with you the rest of your life, didn't it?
Oh, yes. I was so happy years later when I could go back and finally see Juan again, and he had read all the press and this and that. And the gentleman came up and gave me a big hug and said, I think you gave back. And that meant more to me.
Yeah, wow. I cannot imagine the pride that man had in you and the feeling that you had of that getting that acknowledgement, especially given your childhood. Man, that's
that should be the last scene in the movie. That should be the last scene. That's the emotional last scene in the movie, absolutely.
Paul's got to put his fingerprints on it.
I'm telling you, no, that's what you just said, because it's all about closing that circle, the confusion of your life. Who am I? Where, you know, my mother wants me, she doesn't want me. All this craziness you go through, and where am I going, and where am I headed, and what's this all mean? And then you die and come back, and why me? You know, why was I allowed to come back? You're allowed to come back to complete this, certainly some people would say. And that completion of that journey that you started has got to be going back and seeing that man and saying, thumbs up, attaboy.
Well, and we all are our own worst enemies sometimes, you know, and self doubt and all this stuff. And I mean, and like I said, I wanted to point out that, you know, you had an openness because of maybe what happened during therapy, but an openness to finding your purpose or understanding that maybe having a purpose is a enriching part of your makeup as your life
or and helps then, you deal with all the insanity
and,
of life here. Yeah,
and
what's
being
it all about?
Open to it, life unfolded the way it was supposed to.
Exactly. And I had the good fortune a couple of years ago of meeting Tanya Brown, as you mentioned earlier in the show.
She's a great person.
And her and I are now developing our own speaking tour to discuss just what you talked about, how those negatives, because of the trauma that she went through in her life.
Tremendous trauma.
And how to turn all those things into the positives. And we've done a couple events already and getting a good reaction.
I can imagine. I have seen you guys both, and I encourage everybody who has an opportunity to go to any of those speaking engagements. We'll post some as I get them, because you and I are friends, and Tanya and I are friends, so we'll share these with people. But, Frank, I thank you so, so very much for being on the show today and sharing your story.
Thank you. That made it real easy. It was an interesting hour.
Well, interesting for us, and thank you for all the services you've done. Thank you for what you've created, and best of luck as you continue this journey and see where it takes you next. Because you're not over yet, right? The journey's not over,
and the door is wide open, buddy. You can call in. I'd love to hear more about it, and I'm sure we'll get you back on here. But have a great, wonderful day, and thank you for everything that you do, Frank.
Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, take care.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gontos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.